The title led me to assume that it was a compilation of his favorite gaming music, and I'd grown up listening to those songs while I played video games too. As a result, listening to my father's old Digital Combat compilation had become an essential part of my Armada gaming ritual. Trying to play without my Raid the Arcade playlist on in the background invariably threw off my aim and my rhythm. That's why I made sure I had it queued up before the start of every mission. I put on the Foe Interceptor pilot helmet and adjusted its built-in noise-canceling headphones, which completely covered each of my ears. After I adjusted the VR goggles to make sure they fit snugly over my eyes, I thumbed the small button that extended the helmet's retractable microphone. A completely pointless, yet undeniably cool feature. Then I retracted and extended the microphone a few more times, just to hear the sound it made. Once the game finished loading, I spent a few minutes customizing the button configuration on my new throttle and flight stick controllers, then logged onto the Armada multiplayer server. I immediately checked the EDA pilot rankings to make sure my ranking hadn't slipped since my last login, but my "so cheesy it was cool" call sign was still there in sixth place. I'd held that spot for over 2 months now, but a part of me was always still shocked to see it there, listed among the top 10, alongside the game's most famous and infamous players. I scanned the familiar collection of call signs, listed in what had now become a familiar order. 1. Red Jive. 2. Max Genius. 3. With Nailed. 4. Viper. 5. Rostam. 6. Iron Beagle. 7. Wody. 8. Crazy G. 9. Atomic Mom. 10. Cushmaster 5000. I had been seeing these 10 call signs almost every night for years, but I didn't actually know who any of those people really were or where they lived either. Aside from a few casual acquaintances at school and work, Cruz and Deal were the only Armada pilots I'd ever met in real life. The game had over 9 million active players in dozens of countries, so clawing my way up into the top 10 had been no easy feat. Even with what I've been told is a natural talent for video games, it had still taken me over 3 years of daily practice before I even managed to crack the top 100. Once I'd crossed that threshold, I finally seemed to find my groove, and in the months that followed, I made a meteoric rise into the top 10, while also rising up the ranks of the Earth Defense Alliance, earning one field promotion after another, until I was promoted all the way up to lieutenant. I knew Armada was only a video game, but I'd never been one of the best at anything before, and my accomplishment gave me a real sense of pride. Admittedly, all the time I'd had to devote to the game had shaved a full point off my grade average, and it had probably cost me my relationship with Ellen, too. But I'd already vowed to turn over a new leaf, I reminded myself. After tonight's mission, no more Armada for at least 2 full weeks, even if that meant sacrificing my position in the top 10. No great loss, I told myself. The higher you were ranked, the more trash talk, friendly fire, and accusations of cheating you had to endure from the other players. Case in point, the Armada pilots currently ranked in the top 5 were easily the most loathed players in the game's brief history. This was partly because the top 5 ranked pilots had the honor of painting their drones with their own customized multicolored designs, while the rest of us flew plain old stainless steel ones. That was how the top 5 had earned their nickname, the Flying Circus. A lot of posters in the Chaos Terrain forums seemed to believe the top 5 pilots were just too good to be real players, and that they had to be NPC bots or Chaos Terrain employees. Others theorized they were an elitist gamer clan because the 5 of them never responded to messages or in-game chat requests. Of course, that may have been because noobs were always accusing them of cheating by using some sort of client hack to auto-aim or give their shields infinite energy, but it was all bullshit sour grapes. I've been going head-to-head with Red Jive, a.k.a. the Red Baron, and the other members of the Flying Circus on the free-for-all deathmatch servers for over a year now, and I'd never once seen any sign they were cheating. They were just better than everyone else. In fact, studying their moves and learning from them was how I'd climbed into the top 10. I still found their general arrogance obnoxious, though, especially Red Jive, who had an infuriating habit of sending the same text message every time he shot someone else down in the game's player versus player practice mode. You're welcome. Those two words would flash on your screen, accompanied by a blood-boiling beep. Red Jive obviously had a macro set up to fire that message like a missile right after he blasted your ship to bits, literally adding insult to injury. I knew why he or she did it, too. It was a tactical move designed to anger his opponents and throw them even further off balance right before they respawned in another ship. And it worked, too, on everyone, including me. But one of these days, when I finally got Red Jive between my crosshairs, it would be my turn to send one of those infuriating texts. No, 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 Red Jive. You're welcome. Of course, now I got accused of hacking all the time, too. To quote my wizened boss, Ray Wierzbowski, "That's how you know you've mastered a video game, when a bunch of butthurt crybabies start to accuse you of cheating in an effort to cope with the beatdown they've just suffered at your hands." When I pulled up my friends list, I saw that Cruz and Deal were both already logged in, their player rankings listed beside their call signs. Cruz, whose call sign was Quoth, was currently in 6,791st place, and Deal, a.k.a. Delio, was ranked 7,445th. Their Terra Firma player rankings were much higher, but they were both still a long way from making it into the 30-dozen like Ray. I switched on my helmet microphone and joined Quoth and Delio on their private voice chat line. "You still won't admit you're wrong?" Cruz was shouting as I logged in. "I told you, your Wonder Woman argument proves nothing," Deal said. "Yes, Princess Diana of the Mascara did once wield Mjolnir in some obscure bullshit crossover issue. That only proves my point, Cruz. Do you think Wonder Woman would ever be caught dead wielding Sting?" "No, but she's a superhero and they don't use swords, do they?" Cruz said, clearly without thinking his statement through. "Superheroes don't use swords," Deal said gleefully. "What about Nightcrawler? Deadpool? Elektra? Shatterstar? Green Arrow? Hawkeye? Oh, and then there's Blade and Katana, two superheroes who are actually named after swords. Oh, and Wolverine had that idiotic Muramasa blade made with part of his soul, which, while incredibly lame, is still a far cooler magical weapon than Sting." "Sorry to interrupt, ladies," I said. "I think you should just agree to disagree." "Iron Seagull," Cruz called out. "I didn't see you log in." "You're late, fool," Deal said. "And Cruz won't shut up about Wonder Woman." "I'm right on time," I said. "The briefing doesn't start for another 30 seconds. "What the hell happened with you and Air Nocta today?" Deal asked. He said it with a thick German accent. "Nothing happened," I said, "because I split before anything did." "Well, he was making threats toward you to his idiot friends after the bell rang," he said. "Vengeance is in his eyes and all that. Plan accordingly." I cleared my throat. "Time is short. Let's talk mission, guys." "If this is another disruptor takedown, I'm out, y'all," Cruz said. "I'll bail and play Terra Firma instead. I'm serious, guys." "What's the matter, Quoth?" I asked. "Don't you enjoy a challenge?" "I enjoy balanced gameplay," Cruz replied. "I'm not a masochist like you." I felt a brief impulse to defend the game, but it was hard to argue the point. The Disruptor was a powerful new weapon the Sobrukai had unveiled after one of the game's most recent content updates. It was capable of disrupting the quantum communication link to all of Earth's defensive drones, rendering them useless. For the past few months, all of the game's most devoted players, myself included, have been trying to figure out how to disable the Disruptor's defenses and destroy the damn thing. But so far, the Sobrukai's new superweapon had proven to be indestructible, and that made many of the game's higher-level missions more or less unwinnable. Despite the endless barrage of complaints claiming that Chaos Terrain had broken and or ruined their own game, the company refused to remove the Disruptor from the enemy's arsenal or make it easier to destroy. As a result, a lot of Armada players were defecting to play Terra Firma. The Disruptor never showed up in any TF mission, maybe because by the time one made landfall, there was nothing the EDA's ground troops could do to stop it. It's a new mission, I said. Be optimistic. There might not be a disruptor in it.
Yeah, Deal said. Maybe the devs have cooked up something even worse.
What could possibly be worse? Cruz asked. A mission where you have to blow up a Death Star while being attacked by two Borg cubes inside an asteroid field?
Cruz, Deal immediately chimed in.
I highly doubt that either the Borg or...
Thankfully, an alert sounded in our headphones just then, signaling the start of the mission briefing. All of the data display windows vanished, and I found myself seated in a packed briefing room with Cruz's and Deal's uniformed avatars, Quoth and Delio, sitting on either side of me. We had each customized our avatars so that they vaguely resembled our real selves, only slightly taller, more muscular, and less pale. The avatars of a few other last-minute arrivals were materializing in the tiered seats around us. In the fictional near-future reality of Armada, Cruz, Deal, and I were drone pilots stationed at Moonbase Alpha, a top-secret military outpost on the moon's far side. They were both lowly corporals, while I held the coveted rank of lieutenant. The lights in the virtual briefing room dimmed, and the spinning crest of the Earth Defense Alliance appeared on the view screen in front of us. As the crest faded away, it was replaced by the familiar face of Admiral Archibald Vance, the Earth Defense Alliance's highest-ranking officer. The actor Chaos Terrain had hired to portray the Admiral totally nailed the part. His jagged facial scar and eye patch might have seemed over the top on another actor, but this guy somehow managed to sell the whole look and make you believe he really was a battle-hardened military commander facing impossible odds with weary determination and grim resolve.
"Greetings, pilots," the Admiral said, addressing us from the view screen. "This evening's mission will not be an easy one, but it's one I know many of you have been hoping and waiting for since this war first began. Humanity has suffered countless unprovoked attacks from these alien invaders over the years, but now we're finally going to take this fight to them."
The corners of the Admiral's mouth turned upward in the faintest hint of a smile, the closest I'd ever seen him come to displaying an emotion.
"Tonight, we're finally going to hit them where they live. Literally."
The view screen window displaying the Admiral's face shrank and moved to the top right-hand corner, while the rest of the screen displayed a technical diagram of a ship model I'd never seen before. Its design reminded me a little bit of the Sulaco from Aliens. Its elongated, armored hull made it look like a heavy-caliber machine gun drifting through the void of space.
"This is the EDA's first interstellar drone carrier, the SS Doolittle. After traveling for over 2 years and nearly 7 times the speed of light, the Doolittle has finally reached its target. And your target for this mission, the enemy's home planet of Sobrakai."
"Finally!"
Cruz shouted over the comm, perfectly echoing my own reaction. All of the previous Armada missions had been focused on defense, and the game's action had always been confined to our own solar system, oftentimes on Earth itself, in the skies over a major city or military outpost the Sobrakai were attacking, although we'd also locked horns with them out beyond the orbit of Mars, near the edge of the asteroid belt, and on the far side of the moon. This was the first mission that had ever involved an offensive against our enemy, and we'd hit the motherlode.
"As soon as the Doolittle reaches Sobrakai's orbit," the Admiral went on, "it will deactivate its cloaking device before launching the Icebreaker, our weapon of last resort, along with an escort of fighters that will be under your control."
The Admiral began to play the tactical previs on the screen. The computer animation showed the cloaked Doolittle swinging into orbit above Sobrakai, and the armada of glittering warships that encircled its equator like an artificial planetary ring. Spaced out evenly along this ring were 6 massive chrome orbs, Sobrakai dreadnought spheres. The players had nicknamed them motherships. This was the first time we'd ever had to go up against more than one of them. The bay doors embedded on the starboard side of the Doolittle's bow irised open, and the Icebreaker launched out of it, accompanied by a dense escort of 3 dozen fighters. The Icebreaker looked like what it was: a giant focused beam laser bolted to an orbital nuclear weapons platform. The moment it began to fire its powerful melt laser down at the thick layer of ice covering the planet's surface, Sobra Kai fighters began to pour out of the six dreadnought spheres, streaming forth from glowing, slit-like hangar doors that had opened in their armored skins to engage with the comparatively tiny group of EDA fighters protecting the Doomsday weapon being fired directly down at the icy roof of their squid crib.
"Eat it!" Deal cried in mock triumph. "How does it feel, assholes? You like that?"
I smiled under my helmet. Deal was right. After months of getting our asses handed to us on our home court, this chance to strike back at the Sobra Kai on theirs was going to be hugely cathartic.
"Your mission is to keep the icebreaker operational for approximately 3 minutes, just long enough for it to melt through the ice and launch its warheads into the planet's subsurface ocean, destroying the enemy's underwater lair, an aquatic hive located on the ocean floor."
The tactical animation showed our drone fighters handily defending the icebreaker from the enraged enemy armada just long enough for it to finish melting its giant hole and launch its warheads through it into the planet's subsurface ocean. At this point, the ICBMs transformed into guided nuclear torpedoes, which quickly homed in on the Sobra Kai's underwater cave city, which looked like a high-tech hive built into the ocean's rocky floor.
"Now I feel bad," Deal said. "Like we're about to nuke Aquaman. Or the Little Mermaid?"
"Pretend they're Gungans," Cruz said, "and that we get to nuke Jar Jar."
They both laughed, but I was still focused on the tactical animation. It showed the EDA's torpedo nukes closing in on the Sobra Kai's aquatic hive like a volley of squid-seeking missiles. A few of them were knocked out by the hive's defense turrets, but the vast majority reached their target. The ensuing detonations lit up the view screen like an old-school game of Missile Command. Sobra Kai Central was obliterated, and the force of the subsequent thermonuclear explosions rocked the planet so violently that cracks spread across the entire circumference of its icy surface, making it resemble a shattered, hard-boiled egg. There were no mushroom clouds, only a massive column of red steam rising from the massive hole burned in the surface, which shot straight up into orbit as if the planet were spraying blood from a gunshot wound.
"It's another suicide mission," Cruz said, "but it still looks fun. I'm in."
It looked as if our inept alien enemy had made another colossal tactical mistake. They had not only let their faster-than-light propulsion technology fall into our reverse engineering monkey hands, they had then given us enough time to build an interstellar warship of our own and send it all the way across the vast gulf of space to launch a counterattack against them. As usual, the alien invaders' tactics didn't make a whole lot of sense. And as usual, I didn't care. I just wanted to kill me some aliens, and this was the juiciest setup for a balls-out kamikaze mission in the history of the game. Maybe any game. In my headset, the Admiral's voice was drowned out by the sound of Deal pretending to snore.
"Come on, old man," he shouted. "Less talk, more rock."
"Yeah, I wish we could skip this storyline crap," Cruz said. "Boring." "See? This is exactly why you two always get killed within the first 2 minutes," I said. "You never pay attention during the Admiral's briefing."
"No, we always get killed because of you, Leroy Jenkins."
"I've asked you repeatedly to stop calling me that."
"If the shoe fits, smack attack," Cruz said. "Why don't you try being a team player for once? Just once."
"Interplanetary warfare isn't a team sport," I replied. "Never has been."
"Actually, it kinda is, if you think about it," Deal chimed in. "The home team versus the visitors. Get it? Visitors?"
After a pause, he added,
"Because they're aliens?"
"Yeah, we got it," I said. "Will everybody shut up so I can hear the rest of this?"
"This mission must succeed," the Admiral was telling us now. "That armada is preparing to depart for Earth. So this is our one and only chance to destroy the Sobra Kai before they come here to destroy us. The fate of humanity depends on the icebreaker reaching its target."
He paused to clasp his hands behind his back.
"We're only going to get one shot at this, people, so let's make it count."
"Are you kidding?" Cruz shouted, as if the pre-recorded actor could hear him.
"This better not be a single-play mission. It's way too awesome!"
"He was just saying that for dramatic effect," I said. "I'm sure we'll be able to replay it, just like with the disruptor scenarios."
You better be right, Deal said, because there's no way in hell we're going to pull this mission off on our first try. Or our second or third, either. They've got 6 dreadnought spheres, each one loaded with over 1 billion killer alien drones, and a disruptor to boot. They won't activate one of their disruptors here, Cruz pointed out. It wouldn't have any effect. For a quantum link to be disrupted, both the transmitting and receiving ends have to be inside the sphere. That was the reason the EDA had drones and humans stationed on the far side of the moon. With no disruptor to worry about, this should be doable, I said. All we have to do is protect that icebreaker for 3 minutes. No problemo. No problem, Cruz repeated. Really? You think so? Yeah, we just, you know, create a blockade. With what? Cruz said. Did you check the mission stats? Our carrier only brought 200 drones along. The Admiral failed to mention that. Maybe he did it when you two were snoring, I suggested. Like I said before, this is yet another example of unbalanced, poorly thought-out gameplay, he continued. The devs at Chaos Train are trying to piss us off now. We're going to get slaughtered again. Yeah, yeah, Deal said. How do I get out of this chicken shit outfit? I laughed. Before Cruz could reply, we realized that Admiral Vance was bringing his chalk talk to a close. Good luck, pilots. Everyone down here on Earth is counting on you. He snapped us a farewell salute, and his image winked out on the view screen, once again replaced by the Earth Defense Alliance crest. Then, while the mission loaded, we were all treated to a familiar cutscene showing our squadron of heroic-looking, slightly out-of-focus EDA pilots sprinting out the briefing room's exit, down a brightly lit access corridor, and on into the Moonbase Alpha Drone Operations Control Center, a large circular room with dozens of oval hatchways embedded in the floor, spaced only a few meters apart, each containing a drone controller pod. Their hatches hissed open, revealing simulated interceptor cockpits, each one a pilot seat surrounded by an array of controls and readouts, along with a wraparound view screen shaped like a cockpit canopy window. The cutscene ended, and my perspective shifted back to my avatar's POV. Only now, I was sitting inside my own drone controller pod. A second later, the hatch hissed closed above me, just as all of the control panels around me lit up, as did the wraparound view screen. This created a second layer of simulation. The illusion that I was now sitting inside an ADI-88 aerospace drone interceptor, powered up and waiting in its coiled launch rack in the Doolittle's drone hangar. I reached out to blindly place my hands on the new controllers in front of me, adjusting their placement to match the layout of my virtual cockpit inside the game. Then, I took a deep breath and exhaled it slowly, trying to relax. This was usually the best part of my day, when I got to escape my suburban existence for a few hours and become a crack fighter pilot duking it out with evil alien invaders. But tonight, I didn't feel like I was escaping anything. I felt anxious, excited, righteous, maybe even a little bloodthirsty. Like I was going to war. Six. The goggles inside my new Armada VR helmet provided me with an immersive 360-degree view from inside my drone's simulated cockpit. Looking out through its wraparound canopy, I could see the Doolittle's drone launch hangar. I glanced left and then right, taking in the row of identical interceptors lined up on either side of me, gleaming under the hangar dome's floodlights, ready for launch. My heads-up display appeared, superimposed over my wraparound view out of the cockpit, providing readouts of my starship's flight, weapon, and communication systems, along with radar, sensor, and navigation data. I cleared my throat and addressed TAC, my ship's tactical avionics computer. TAC served as a virtual co-pilot, managing my ship's navigation, weapons, and communication systems, and providing me with verbal status updates. TAC could also give novice pilots helpful on-the-fly recommendations on how to improve their maneuvering techniques and weapon usage, but I'd disabled that feature long ago. TAC, prepare all systems for launch, I said.
Compliance!
TAC chirped brightly. At the default setting, the computer spoke in a perpetually calm, synthesized female voice that I found unnerving in the heat of battle, so I'd installed several other custom sound profiles, including one called Trimaxian, which gave it the voice of the ship's computer in Flight of the Navigator.
It made my ship's voice sound like Pee-wee Herman yelling through a vocoder, but this amused me and kept me on my toes. Each interceptor's thrusters, weapons, and shields were powered by a fusion reactor that constantly recharged its drone's power cells, but it did so at a very slow rate, so you needed to use your power sparingly during battle, otherwise you'd end up floating through space, a sitting duck with a dead stick. It was easy to run out of juice during the heat of combat, because every time you moved or fired your weapons, it used up some of your power, and whenever your shields took a direct hit, that drained your power cells too. When they started to get too low, your drone would lose its shields first, then its weapons, and finally its thrusters. Then your drone would crash and burn, or if you were lucky enough to be fighting in space, it would just begin to drift helplessly through the void while you waited for the power cells to recharge enough for your thrusters to come back online, praying that an enemy ship didn't pick you off first, which it almost always did. The enemy Glaive fighters had blaster turrets mounted on each of their wingtips that could rotate in any direction, giving them an almost unlimited field of fire. But my interceptor's plasma cannons, aka sun guns and Macross missiles, were both forward-firing weapons, so my target needed to be in front of me if I was going to be able to hit it. My ship had a laser turret, however, that was able to fire in any direction, but unlike my sun guns, the turret used up a lot of power and had to be used sparingly. Our ships were also each equipped with a self-destruct mechanism, which also served as a weapon of last resort. As long as your drone had even a tiny bit of power remaining, you could detonate its reactor core in an explosion that could vaporize everything within a tenth of a kilometer. If you timed it right, you could take out nearly a dozen enemy ships at once with this tactic. Unfortunately, the enemy also had the ability to detonate their power cores, and they didn't care about taking out friendlies when they did it. A lot of players didn't either, of course. For some, it was their only real strategy. The only major downside to pulling this self-destruct move was that it meant you would miss at least part of the battle, because before you could fly back out to rejoin the fight, you had to wait to take control of another drone back inside the hangar, and then wait for it to reach the front of the launch queue, all of which could take up to a minute or more, depending on how fast the enemy was dropping our drones. A klaxon began to sound as the hangar's belt-fed launch rack whirred into action and began to deploy the interceptors slotted ahead of mine, one after the other, firing them out of the belly of the Doolittle like bullets from a machine gun. "Huzzah!" I heard Delio say. "Now I finally get to kill some aliens!" "Not if you get waxed before you fire a single shot," Cruz said, "like last time." "I told you my internet connection went out!" Delio shouted. "Dude, we heard you cursing on the comm after you got killed," I reminded him. "That proves nothing," he said cheerfully. Then he shouted, "Cry havoc!" When neither of us followed suit, he cleared his throat loudly over the comm. "Why didn't either of you cry havoc with me just now?" he asked. "You bitches best be crying me some havoc. You want to jinx us?" "Sorry, Delio," I said. Then, as loud as I could, I shouted, "Cry havoc!" "I'll leave the crying to you guys," Cruz said, before muttering his own personal pre-throwdown mantra to himself. "Let's do this." I cracked my knuckles, then pressed play on the best ass-kicking track on my father's old Raid the Arcade mix. As the opening bass line of Queen's Another One Bites the Dust began to thud over my helmet's built-in headphones, I felt myself begin to slip into the zone. The song's machine gun beat was a perfect match for the timing and rhythm of the enemy ships in nearly every kind of mission. We Will Rock You worked really well for me during shooting gallery scenarios like this one, too. When Freddie Mercury's vocals kicked in a few seconds later, I cranked up the volume in my headset, apparently loud enough for my microphone to pick it up. "Oh, great," Cruz said. "Sounds like DJ Geriatric is spinning again tonight. What a surprise." "If it's too loud, you're too old, Quoth," I shot back. "Why don't you mute me and put on the latest Kids Bop compilation instead?" "Perhaps I will," he replied. "They're unappreciated musical geniuses, you know." The two drones Cruz and Deal were controlling launched out of the hangar just ahead of me, each labeled with their call sign on my HUD.
"Attention! Your drone is next in the launch queue,"
my computer announced with far too much enthusiasm.
"Prepare to engage the enemy!"
The belt cycled forward again, feeding my drone into the launch tunnel and then blasting it out in space. And then
It was on like red dawn. The first wave of responding enemy ships was already pouring out of the bottom of the nearest dreadnought sphere, like hornets from a metal hive, and streaking down on us out of the blackness, approaching fast along our 12 o'clock. A split second later, the space in front of my drone was filled with hundreds of Sobrakai Glaive fighters, along with dozens of dragon-like wyverns uncoiling and snaking through their swarming ranks, all of them moving in unison as they moved to attack the icebreaker. I held my breath as I targeted one of the lead glaives. I felt like I had a grudge to settle with the damn thing, for escaping from my fantasy life to invade my reality, and for making me question my own sanity in the process. My three-dimensional tactical display flashed, warning me of a reactor detonation directly behind me, and I accelerated just in time to escape being caught in the blast. Lasting longer than a few minutes in a battle of this size wasn't easy. Evading enemy fire required lightning-fast reflexes, wicked spatial awareness, and a gift for pattern recognition. You had to learn how to find the best route to cut through the enemy's ranks, retreating and attacking simultaneously. Once I'd spent enough hours studying how the Sobrakai ships moved and attacked as a group, I gradually began to see the patterns hidden in all that chaos. Sometimes they moved like a flock of birds, chasing its own tail as it circled for a landing. Other times, they made sharp turns in the sky, like a school of predatory fish, but there was always a pattern to it, and recognizing it allowed me to anticipate the enemy's movements and reactions, and that made it relatively easy for me to get them in my sights, as long as I was listening to the right music. Music was key. The old rock songs on my father's old mixtapes were perfect, because they had a steady, hard-driving beat that served as my mental combat metronome. I cut my engines and fired my retrothrusters, swinging my ship around 180 degrees without altering or slowing my forward momentum. Then I opened fire on the swarm of glaives converging on the icebreaker's tail with a series of bursts from my sun guns. When I hit my first target, it imploded into collapsing fireballs of superheated plasma in front of me, and a message flashed on my HUD informing me I'd made the first kill of the engagement. One down, a few million to go, I announced over the comm, already buzzing with adrenaline. Killing video game aliens had always been an outlet for my adolescent frustrations, but tonight, it felt as though I was venting compressed rage each time I pulled the trigger. It didn't matter that the Sobrakai were fictional. I still wanted to kill every last one of them. Guys, I've got two glaives on my tail, Deal announced. Any help? Help yourself, pal, I heard Cruz say. We're all getting our asses handed to us. Not me, I replied. I am officially in the zone. I scanned my scopes, but neither Quoth nor Delio was currently visible because the icebreaker was now directly between us. I fired my lateral thrusters and did a series of diving barrel rolls to evade the incoming barrage of plasma bolts streaking past me on all sides. I also teased the throttle to vary my ship's speed and angle of ascent while I lined up my omnidirectional laser turret's targeting reticle with a new threat. A train of three glaives I'd just picked up on my tail, looming on my HUD's aft display. The moment I got a targeting lock on the leader, I thumbed the laser turret's trigger. The beam only lasted for a split second, and it wasn't visible with the naked eye, but its exact trajectory appeared on my HUD. I watched as it burned through the hull of the glaive closest to my tail, then continued burning on through the other two glaives directly behind that one, destroying them in a rapid chain of explosions. Boom! Boom! Ba-boom! I powered down my already overheating laser, then switched back to my plasma cannons, which automatically reoriented my HUD so that it showed what was in front of my ship instead of the dissipating fireball in its wake. Then, I threw the throttle wide open. But as I passed under the icebreaker and prepared to swing up on its opposite side, two more glaives reappeared on my tail. They dropped in directly behind me, and I started to take heavy fire, knocking my shields down by half and putting even more of a drain on my power cells, which were already dangerously low. According to my HUD, the icebreaker had been firing its melt laser for less than a minute, and the Sobrakai had already destroyed nearly half of our interceptors. Reinforcements were still pouring out of the Doolittle's hangar, but these drones were all piloted by players who had already gotten themselves killed once, and most of them would be destroyed a second time within seconds of rejoining the battle. Cruz was right. We weren't going to be able to hold them off long enough. Screw this, I said. I'm going to try and create a diversion. Where are you going? Cruz said over the comm. Protect the icebreaker, dumbass! Sorry, Cruz, I said, pushing my throttle forward, but you'll never guess who just showed up. Leroy! Oh, Lightman, don't you even dare! Jenkins!
I broke formation with the others, leaving the icebreaker behind as I moved to attack the nearest dreadnought. I slammed my throttle forward and crossed in front of it, strafing the turrets spaced along the sphere's equator, taking out one or two of them.
God damn it, Zack! Cruz shouted. Every time! Every goddamn time!
I grinned and fired my thrusters, putting my fighter into an instantaneous vertical dive with the intention of slipping under the sphere to strafe its shield. This maneuver cost me nearly a third of my remaining power, because my interceptor had to momentarily activate its inertia cancellation field to execute it. But I shook several of the Sobrakai fighters off my tail, because they needed to execute the same move to stay on me, and most of them didn't have enough power. Instead, they had to fishhook around behind me and then try to get a bead on my interceptor again when I was already gone. Another swarm of glaives emerged from the nearby dreadnought, all diving at the icebreaker in a straight line, firing in tandem. I shredded them with a single sustained burst from my sun guns, bringing my Sobrakai kill count up to 9. Not bad, but also not up to my usual standards. My aim was a bit off.
Shit! I heard Deal shout over the comm. I just lost my Goram shields because I'm already out of frackin' power.
Dude, Cruz said, you shouldn't mix swears from different universes.
Says who? Deal shot back. Besides, what if BSG and Firefly took place in the same universe? You ever consider that?
I heard a thunderous series of explosions behind me and swung my head around just in time to see the IDC Doolittle erupt into a huge fireball amid a hail of enemy plasma fire.
What did I tell you? Cruz muttered into his headset. There goes the carrier and the rest of our drone reserves.
Yeah, and that goddamn icebreaker still isn't finished making a stupid ice fishing hole either, Deal added.
Game over, man! Game the fuck over!
Not yet, I muttered. Clenching my teeth, I swung my interceptor back around and returned to try to help defend the icebreaker, targeting the cluster of glaives attacking its aft thrusters, but I couldn't get a lock on any of the targets flashing on my HUD, because I kept having to dodge incoming enemy fire as well as friendly fire from the sentry guns on the icebreaker's armored skin as my drone skimmed over it. My drone took 2 more direct hits, knocking my shields down to 15%. 1 more hit and they would fail, and my weapons would follow soon after. Not good. I jammed my flight stick forward, cutting into a sharp dive to avoid flying right into the beam of the icebreaker's pulsing melt laser. Ignoring Tack's warnings about my drone's imminent power failure, I gunned the throttle and continued turning into a barrel roll, both sun guns still blazing.
Shit!
I heard Deal curse.
They got me, guys. I'm out.
I glanced at my HUD, just in time to see Deal's interceptor vanish off my scopes.
Me too,
Cruz added a second later. He unleashed a colorful stream of profanity on his comm and logged out of the game completely. The digital deaths of my 2 best friends distracted me just long enough to take another series of direct hits, causing my shields and weapons to fail. I immediately initiated the self-destruct sequence on my drone's power core, even though I knew it was unlikely I would last the 7 seconds required for it to complete. All of the glaive fighters in the vicinity began to redirect their fire at me, hoping to destroy my core before it could complete its countdown and go critical. But, in doing so, they were momentarily forced to take their focus off the icebreaker, just as I'd hoped. 5 seconds remaining on my drone self-destruct sequence. Then 4, 3, but that was when the inevitable happened. The icebreaker finally took 1 hit too many and exploded directly beneath me. The ensuing fireball destroyed my drone, along with every ship within its blast radius. Ominous music began to play in my headphones as the words, "Mission Failed," appeared, superimposed over my now disembodied view of the Sobrakai Armada as each of the 6 dreadnought spheres began to recall their remaining drones and return to their original formation in orbit, with this minor threat to their world now vanquished. I blindly powered off my game console and sat in the darkness for a moment before pulling off my VR helmet and returning to the real world with a sigh. My phone rang a few seconds later. Cruz was on the line. He had already checked and wanted to let me know that attack on Sobrakai wasn't on the list of replayable missions, at least not yet. Then he conferenced Diehl in for his traditional post-mission bitch fest. After, the Mikes tried to cajole me into joining them on a terra firma mission, but I mumbled something about having homework and said I'd see them at school tomorrow. Then I got up and went over to my closet. When I opened the door, a small avalanche of stuff spilled out onto my feet. I rummaged through the dense forest of dress shirts and winter coats on plastic hangers until I found my father's old jacket way at the back. It was an old black baseball jacket with leather sleeves, and it was completely covered front and back with embroidered patches, all somehow science fiction or video game related, including several high-score award patches for old Activision games like Star Master, Dreadnought Destroyer, Laser Blast, and Kaboom. Running down both sleeves were logos and military insignia from the Rebel Alliance, the Star League, the United Federation of Planets, the Colonial Fleet from BSG, and the Robotech Defense Force, among others. I studied each one in turn, running my fingertips over the embroidery. When I'd last tried this jacket on a few years ago, it had still been too big on me. But when I slipped it on now, it fit me perfectly, almost as if it had been tailor-made. I found myself itching to wear it to school tomorrow, despite my earlier vow to stop living in the past and obsessing over the father I had never known. I looked around at the posters, toys, and models that filled my room, and felt a pang in my chest at the thought of moving all my dad's prized possessions up into the attic. Despite my good intentions, it seemed I wasn't quite ready to let go of my father. Not yet. I leaned back in my chair, stifling a yawn that did not wish to be stifled. I did a quick systems-wide status check, the results of which confirmed that my wagon was Dragon, plutonium chamber empty, sleep required immediately. I took 3 steps toward my bed and collapsed face first onto my vintage Star Wars bedsheets, where I immediately fell into a fitful sleep. My dreams that night were plagued by visions of a giant Sobrakai overlord constricting its enormous tentacles around a defenseless planet Earth, as if preparing to swallow it whole. 7. When I walked out to my car the next morning and glanced down to unlock it, I saw the long sine wave gouge that now ran bumper to bumper down the driver's side. Someone had keyed my car. I turned to scan the surrounding houses on the off chance Notcher was still in the vicinity, but he was nowhere to be seen, and it occurred to me he had probably done this last night while the Omni was parked outside Starbase Ace. I just hadn't noticed after work because it was dark out, and my car's paint job wasn't exactly unblemished to begin with. I turned back to resurvey the damage, this time in the context of the vehicle's overall condition. The long scratch Notcher had added would be barely noticeable to anyone else. One of the few perks of driving an ancient, rusted-out shit wagon was that it took real effort to make it look any less aesthetically pleasing than it already was. This realization allowed me to calm myself enough to heed the whispered advice of Master Yoda, now on repeat in my head.
Let go of your anger.
I often tried to calm myself with Yoda's voice, which sounded nothing like Fozzie Bear, damn you, during moments of distress. Obi-Wan or Qui-Gon or Mace Windu sometimes had calming movie quote wisdom to share, too. That was only on good days, of course. On the bad ones, I found myself drawing on equally compelling advice from Lords Vader or Palpatine. But it wasn't their dark influence that motivated me to get the tire iron out of the Omni's trunk and place it inside my backpack. It was the voice of my friend Diehl, recounting his warning last night about Notcher's threat to seek revenge. I parked my car in the student lot and trudged toward my school's front entrance while counting off the number of days remaining in my sentence, only 45 more to go. But when I reached the open grassy area bordering the parking lot, Notcher was there waiting for me, along with 2 of his brain trust buddies. All 3 were grinning, arms folded across their chests like goons in some Power Rangers episode. My gaze shot over to the school's front entrance, calculating the distance. If I tried, I could probably make it there before they stopped me, but I found that I didn't want to. Notcher was standing out in front. As I'd feared, keying my car wasn't enough. He decided that his manhood was now in question, and that he had no choice but to corner me and deliver a beating, with some help, of course. Notcher's two gargantuan pals were known around school as the Lennies, even though neither of them was actually named Lenny. They'd been saddled with this nickname after our class read Of Mice and Men in sophomore English. I didn't think the moniker really fit. Yes, they were both big and dumb, like the character in the book, but deep down, Steinbeck's Lenny had been a kind-hearted soul. The two Lennies standing in front of me now, who I thought of as Skinhead Lenny and Neck Tattoo Lenny, respectively, were both as mean as they were massive. But their size was dwarfed by the epic scope of their stupidity. "Love your new jacket," Notcher said. He made a show of slowly circling me to examine each of the patches sewn onto it. "These are really impressive. Is there a little rainbow patch on there somewhere, too?" After a few seconds of processing time, both of the Lennies chuckled. That was how long it took their reptilian brains to complete Notcher's elegant rainbow equals gay equation. When I failed to respond, Notcher tried again. "You know, that sort of looks like a varsity letterman's jacket," he said. "If being a video game nerd who can't get laid was a sport," he laughed. "Then I suppose you'd be our star quarterback, eh, Lightman?" I could already feel my anger spiraling out of control. What had made me think it was a good idea to wear my father's old jacket to school? I'd basically been inviting public ridicule on the one topic guaranteed to set me off. And of course, Notcher would be the one to take the bait. Maybe that was why I'd done it in the first place. The same reason I'd confronted Notcher yesterday. Some angry caveman lobe of my brain was itching for a fight, and so I had orchestrated this confrontation. This was my doing. Notcher and the Lennies took a step toward me, but I stood my ground. "At least you were smart enough to bring backup this time," I said, as I slipped off my backpack and took both of its shoulder straps in my right hand, feeling the comforting weight of the tire iron inside. Notcher's smile momentarily faltered, then twisted into a sneer. "They're just here to make sure you don't fight dirty," he said, "like last time." Then, in direct contradiction to what he'd just said, Notcher nodded at the Lennies, and all three of them began to spread out, forming a rough semicircle around me. In my head, I thought I could hear the cracked but commanding voice of Emperor Palpatine saying,
"Use your aggressive feelings, boy. Let the hate flow through you."
"You're in deep shit now, eh, Lightman?" Notcher sneered. "Kinda like your old man." I knew Notcher was trying to push my buttons. Unfortunately, he'd pushed the big red one first. The ICBMs had just left their silos, and now there was no recalling them. I didn't remember unzipping my backpack or taking out the tire iron, but I must have, because now I had the cold steel rod clenched in my hand, and I was raising it to strike. All three of my opponents stood frozen for a moment, their eyes wide. The Lennies threw up their hands and started backing away. Notcher's eyes flicked over to them, and I saw him registering that his simian pals had bowed out of the fight. He started moving backward, too. I looked at the curb a few feet behind him, had a nasty thought, and followed through on it by lunging at Notcher with the tire iron. He lurched backward and, just as I'd hoped, caught a heel on the concrete rise and landed flat on his back. And then I was standing over him, looking down at the tire iron clutched in my hands. Off to my left, someone screamed. My head snapped around and I saw that an audience had gathered, a handful of students on their way into first period. Among them, one girl, too young and deer in the headlights to be anything but a freshman, slapped a hand over her mouth and flinched backward as I looked her way, as if she was terrified that I, Zach, the school psycho, would choose her as my next target. I glanced back at the Lennies, who were now standing among the students who had gathered to watch the fight. All of the onlookers seemed to be wearing the same expression of horrified anticipation, as if they believed they might be seconds away from witnessing their first homicide. A wave of cold shame washed over me as the intensity of my rage faded away. I looked down at the tire iron clutched in my hands and let it clatter to the pavement. I heard a chorus of nervous laughter behind me, along with more than one relieved sigh. I stepped away from Notcher. He slowly got to his feet. We stared at each other for a moment, and he looked as if he was about to say something when his gaze shot upward, focused on something in the sky behind me. When I turned around, I saw a strange-looking aircraft approaching from the east, moving at an incredible speed. The closer it got, the more familiar it looked, My brain still refused to accept what my eyes were seeing until a few seconds later when the craft braked to a dead stop and hovered directly over us, close enough for me to make out the Earth Defense Alliance crest stenciled on the side of its armored hull.
No way, I heard someone whisper.
A second later, I realized it was me. It was an ATS-31 aerospace troop shuttle, one of the ships used by the Earth Defense Alliance in both Armada and Terra Firma, and it was about to land in front of my high school. I definitely wasn't hallucinating this time. Dozens of other people were staring up at the shuttle in amazement, too. And I could hear the rumble of the shuttle's fusion engines and feel the heat from their exhaust buffeting my face. It was really up there. As the shuttle began to descend, everyone in my vicinity scattered like roaches, heading for the safety of the school. I just stood there like a statue, unable to look away. The ship was identical to the troop shuttles I'd piloted while playing Armada, right down to the EDA crest and identification barcode stamped on the underside of its hull. The Earth Defense Alliance can't be real, Zach, I assured myself, and neither can that shuttle you think you're looking at right now. You are hallucinating again, only it's much worse this time. This time, you're having a full-on psychotic break. But I couldn't make myself believe that. There was too much evidence to the contrary. Okay, then, you might be trapped inside a lucid dream like Tom Cruise in Vanilla Sky. Or maybe your reality is really just an incredibly convincing computer simulation, like in The Matrix. Or maybe you just died in a car accident, and this is all an elaborate fantasy playing out in your brain during the last few seconds of your life, like in that one old Twilight Zone episode. As I continued to watch the Earth Defense Alliance shuttle land, I told myself that I had no choice but to roll with the situation as best I could, at least until I woke up, ran into Agent Smith, or heard Rod Serling begin his closing voiceover. The shuttle lowered its landing gear and touched down softly on the broad sidewalk leading up to the school's main entrance. I glanced back at the school and saw faces filling the windows in every classroom, while hundreds of students poured out of every school exit, eager to get a better look at the strange ship and find out what the hell was happening. It was easy to tell which of them recognized the Earth Defense Alliance shuttle. They, like me, were the ones looking the most shocked right now. To everyone else, it probably looked like some new kind of military aircraft, a slightly futuristic cross between a helicopter and a Harrier jet, like the dropships in Avatar or Edge of Tomorrow. The shuttle's automatic doors slid open, and three men wearing dark suits jumped out. They looked like Secret Service agents. Our principal, Mr. Wood, stood there frozen for a few seconds, then rushed forward to greet them, his hand outstretched. After he shook hands with all of them, the shortest of the three removed his sunglasses, and I heard myself gasp. It was Ray Wierzbowski, my boss at Starbase Ace. What the hell was Ray doing here, dressed like one of the men in black? And where the hell had he obtained a working Earth Defense Alliance tactical shuttle? I watched in a daze as Ray flashed some form of ID at Principal Wood. They conferred briefly and shook hands again. Then Ray raised a small bullhorn and used it to address the growing crowd.
"We apologize for interrupting your morning, everyone," Ray said in an uncharacteristically commanding voice that echoed across the school grounds. "But we desperately need to locate Zach Lightman. Does anyone know where he is right now? Zach Lightman? Please, look around and point him out if you see him. We require his assistance with an urgent matter of national security. Zach? Zach Lightman."
I realized Ray was saying my name about the same time I realized that everyone within my field of vision was now staring and pointing at me, including Notcher and both Lennies. It was like that scene from Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Eventually, my public school training took over, and I raised my hand and shouted, "Here!" When he spotted me, Ray grinned and started running across the grass toward me like his life depended on it. It was the fastest I'd ever seen him move.
"Hey there, Zach," he said when he reached me, only slightly out of breath. Then he rested a hand on my shoulder and nodded at the gleaming shuttle behind him. "Want to go for a ride?"
"It's finally happening, Zach. The call to adventure you've been waiting for your whole life. It's standing right in front of you." And I was scared shitless. But I still managed to nod my head and mumble, "Yes."
Ray grinned, proudly, I think, and squeezed my shoulder. I thought so, he said. Follow me, pal. There's no time to lose.
As the entire school looked on, I followed Ray back across the lawn and over to the waiting Earth Defense Alliance shuttle. As the crowd parted to clear a path for us, I spotted my ex-girlfriend, Ellen, staring at me in disbelief from amid the sea of faces. The crowd swelled forward, and I lost sight of her. I spotted Cruz and Deal a few seconds later. They'd managed to push their way to the front of the crowd and were standing a few feet away from the two Secret Service types, who were now standing guard in front of the shuttle, holding the throng at bay with the force-field-like power of their buzz cuts and Ray-Bans.
Zach! Cruz shouted when we made eye contact. What's happening? This is crazy!
Deal shoved him aside and tried to lunge in my direction, his arms flailing like a drowning man.
You lucky bastard! He cried. Tell them to take us, too!
Then I found myself inside the shuttle, in the jump seat directly across from Ray and his two suited companions. The hatch slid closed, silencing the roar of the crowd. Following Ray's example, I buckled my safety harness across my chest and pulled it tight. As soon as he saw that I was safely strapped in, Ray gave a thumbs up to the lone pilot sitting up in the cockpit, who was wearing an honest-to-God Earth Defense Alliance uniform. For a few absurd seconds, I caught myself appreciating the attention to detail this dude had obviously put into his cosplay. Then he completed the shuttle's ignition sequence and fired its engines. As we ascended, my internal monologue went something like this. That isn't some guy cosplaying at SoberCon 4, Zach. To me, he looks like a real EDA pilot in a real-life EDA uniform who's currently piloting the real-life EDA shuttle you appear to be aboard. So, let me see now. Multiply by 2, carry the 1. Hey, that's really weird, but if my math is correct, then the Earth Defense Alliance is fucking real!
I pressed my face to the curved window beside my seat and gazed down at my peers and teachers, still gathered in front of the school far below, already shrinking to the size of ants as we zoomed upward in a surreal blur of speed. But when I closed my eyes, it didn't even feel like we were moving. No G-forces were pushing me back into my seat. The shuttle wasn't even shimmying or vibrating from turbulence as it climbed through the atmosphere. Then I remembered, according to Armada's backstory, all Earth Defense Alliance ships were outfitted with reverse-engineered alien technology, including a Trogheite Slosigite field generator, which created a small inertia cancellation field around a spacecraft by harnessing the aligned spin of gyromagnetic particles to alter the curvature of space-time or something. I'd always assumed this was just more phlebotinum-powered pseudo-scientific hand-wavium, concocted by Chaos Terrain's writers to make their game's impossibly kick-ass outer space dogfights seem mildly plausible, just as Star Trek and Star Wars used inertial dampers and inertial compensators so that Han Solo and Captain Kirk didn't get squished into heroic jelly every time they made the jump to light/warp speed. I clamped my eyes shut again. It still felt like I was sitting in a car idling at a red light. So much for Sir Isaac Newton. A dense layer of clouds obscured the stunning view, and I finally managed to tear my eyes away from the window. I turned to face Ray. He was still smiling. His two stoic companions remained stonily silent and expressionless.
Nice jacket, Ray said. But unlike when Notcher had commented about it, there was no sarcasm in his voice. He leaned forward to admire the patches running down both of my sleeves. I used to have a few of those Activision patches, you know. Not easy to get.
I stared back at him in disbelief. He was making small talk with me, as if we were still behind the counter at Starbase Ace. As if he hadn't just turned my whole notion of reality upside down and inside out. I felt a wave of anger. Mild-mannered, middle-aged Raymond Wierzbowski, my employer, close friend, and surrogate father figure, had clearly lied to me about a great many things. The deceitful bastard obviously knew what was going on, and had for quite some time now. "What the fuck is happening right now, Ray?" I asked, unnerved by the amount of fear in my own voice.
"Somebody set up us the bomb, pal," he quoted. "Now it's time to take off every zig for great justice."
He chuckled softly. I wanted to sock him in the face.
Instead, I started shouting.
Where did you get an Earth Defense Alliance tactical shuttle? How can this thing even be real? And where is it taking us?
Before he could answer, I pointed at the two men seated beside him.
Who are those two clowns? For that matter, who the hell are you, asshole? Huh?